a source of power, of intelligence, of consciousness that far surpasses anything that we have in a human sense. And in particular, if you direct your attention to the heart center, the heart center is different than your physical heart, which is down to the left. Your heart center is right in the center of your chest. When you experience the opening, it becomes very real, very tactile. You know exactly where it is. Directing your attention right to the center of your chest and feel there the essence of your soul, what in India is called the Atma. The Atman is your soul, is that part of you that has always been, is now, and will always be. And so you feel a certain presence there, a certain awareness. When you point to yourself, you oftentimes say, I, and you would point to the center of your chest. This is me. And when you think back in your life, you can think of when you were very young. And there's a certain sense of, this is me. This is who I am. And you might feel it right there in your heart center. And all the way through your years, as you develop and you grow, your thoughts change, your body changes, your emotions change. But there is a changeless aspect to you that you would say, this is me. Establishing yourself in the Atman, you then begin to go into the depth of your being. And this takes you onto a great journey. Because we don't know who or what we are in the beginning. We oftentimes associate, this is my name, this is my body, this is what I do for a living, these are my friends, this is my family. It's all about this body and its relationship to people and things in this world. But you are so much more than that. So much more. And I would like to read from the posting from yesterday entitled Diving Deep. The beautiful picture of Papa Ram Dass with a red flower. Life is not what you think. A few years ago, I had the specter of death following me for a year. That culminated in a severe anemia that led to a diagnosis of tumors. This led to several operations, treatments, and recovery from the treatments. Then recovery led to another stage, the past few years of remission from any tumors. There has been a lot of activity, unknowns that have ultimately led to an excellent health that I enjoy today. And this is just one aspect of my life at that time, concurrently running with so many other parts, projects to complete and service to provide. Now, this is just one life, and since all life is sacred, multiply this life by so many billions of lives, all connecting, all important, all filled with powerful events that matter to the individual and to the lives that person touches. And the essential point is this: while all these life events are important, they are but a tiny portion of a much greater reality. When you think of the ocean, the waves on the ocean surface are powerful and produce a lot of activity. Still, when compared to what is occurring below the surface, there is so much more ocean below than what is seen on the surface. You realize that the surface is but a minuscule percentage of the whole. And while not insignificant, especially to those busy riding the waves, surface living pales in its significance to the real power and life found below. Worldly life is the wave action. The great reality is what lies below. Papa spent the first 30-plus years of his life tossed on the waves, as a boy eluding his school teacher to find a quiet spot to read Shakespeare, a young man learning the textile trade, being a husband and a father, until he experienced a great awakening that led him in a completely new direction toward his beloved Ram. Mother lived as a little girl being hemmed in by the waves. Rules her mother had to not leave the yard when playing, being subject to so much attention, as the only child of 7 to live. A young woman making her way in a work world. And a glimmer of an awakening thought that there is more to existence, that she had a special destiny. But so much lay hidden under the surface until meeting her great guru, who opened a window and showed her there was more to life. For us, what is below the surface is experienced, if we are fortunate, in glimpses of a greater reality, something we know exists but are not very conscious of it, even with the glimpses. To get to this greater reality, we must face a thin film of reality known as the subconscious mind. Through dreams and introspection, we gain greater awareness of the subconscious mind, those thoughts and emotions that are stored from times past. Sometimes these memories are compressed psychic energy because they have been repressed. This reservoir of psychic energy can be a powerful player in the life, making fears, desires, both useful and destructive habits, come to us from surprising depths. It is our past, the good, the bad, and the ugly, bubbling up to the surface and costing us an enormous amount of mental energy to keep it at bay. Besides the relatively thin layer of the subconscious mind, there is the vast superconscious mind, not usually directly perceived by the conscious mind. When the superconscious mind illumines the conscious mind, it brings inspiration, intuitive flashes of truth, a higher order of reality that supersedes either the normal waking conscious mind or the oftentimes murky depths of the subconscious mind. Even a glimpse of the beauty and transcendence of the superconscious mind can inspire life to new heights, awakens an awareness to a new way of experiencing a life. It is the doorway to the vast ocean that creates the waves of the creation on the surface. But oh, it is so much more. The superconscious mind reveals what we call God and God consciousness. When this awakening occurs, what before may have been dismissed as myth because it does not appear to belong to the surface waves of creation of the material world, suddenly takes on more than a theoretical potential, but a living reality that is undeniable, powerful, and enthralling. The old notion that the world of the five senses and what the human mind makes of this physical world is the ultimate reality falls away, and what is born is a vast reality, the reality of the tremendous ocean under the waves. This reality is blissful, enlightening, and leads to the supreme truth. The alternating waves of this material reality fade into a shadowy twilight compared to the rising dawn that reveals a bright and beautiful world all around. The astounded conscious mind discovers this reality has always been with us, only the ordinary mind simply did not have the light to see it. The Buddha is a title that means the awakened one, having the same meaning as the title the Christ, the anointed one. It denotes the one who is awake to the greater reality, sees it through newly awakened eyes, new understanding and awareness. All those called to this path are here to awaken to this greater reality. While we must navigate the waves on the surface of this material reality, our greater task is to explore the immensity below the waves. The story is told of the pearl divers. The pearl divers swim under the surface to find the valuable pearl, but only the divers who are willing to dive deep will discover it and know the wealth it promises. We too must learn to dive deep, to drop further down into meditation, to truly experience the greater reality. To merely play on the surface will never awaken this deeper life. God is bliss, ever new joy, shining truth, and a living awareness of the eternal nature of life. All of this waits the pearl diver for the God experience. It awaits you. Started a book that has just come out. It is a biography of Paramahansa Yogananda, and it's written, the author is not a devotee, but he's an admirer of masters. He first read the autobiography of a yogi in 1970, and was greatly inspired by it. He was a TMer, and he was going to teach TM. And so that's a little his background. He's written books on the Vedas, and so he's well-read in the Eastern mysteries. And it's entitled The Life of Yogananda. I did receive a review from one devotee, and they liked it very much. I've just begun it. I had pre-ordered it, but I'm just now getting to read it. It just came out a week ago or so. So I'd like to read a little bit from it. And this is when writing about when Master was a boy. When he was 8, he experienced, meaning Master, a miraculous healing by Lari Mahasaya's grace. Stricken by Asiatic cholera, an infectious disease that claimed many lives in that era, he lay enfeebled on what his family feared was his deathbed. His mother implored him to inwardly kneel in supplication to the Guru. He did so, gazing at the photograph, and soon saw that what he called a blinding light permeated the room. His symptoms immediately disappeared, he says. Copies of that sanctified photo of Lari Mahasaya now adorn the altar of every center and temple in Yogananda's lineage, as well as the altars, bureaus, and tabletops of millions of devotees. It even played a role in literary history. As a young man, J.D. Salinger, the celebrated author of The Catcher in the Rye and other classics, was determined to achieve enlightenment. Convinced that the lofty goal required renouncing worldly desires, he struggled to overcome a strong urge to mate. When he read the autobiography of a yogi that Lari Mahasaya had been a family man, he realized he'd been wrong. Wife and children followed, along with initiation into Yogananda's teachings. He reportedly gave his kids that photo of Lahari to keep them with them. The spiritual inclinations Mukunda displayed at an early age were nourished not only at home, but by the town in which he spent his first 8 years. Gorakhpur was named for one of the many religious reformers in Indian history. Gorakhnath was a sainted yogi who was thought to have lived in the 11th century CE, the Common Era. He is credited with founding the Nath order of ascetics, although some say that tradition actually predates him and his role was to solidify and expand it. Every Sunday, Mukunda's parents would take him with them to worship at the 12th century Gorakhnath temple, about a mile from their home. One Sunday when they skipped the temple because they were hosting a ceremonial event. Late that night, when the festivities had ended, Mukunda was not to be found. Anxious family and friends scoured the neighborhood to no avail. Then his mother thought of checking the temple. Her son was there, meditating. Despite the lateness of the hour and the trouble he had caused his parents, he let them finish his sadhana. Reminded me of when Christ was at the temple and teaching, his parents couldn't find him and came back there and found him there. So his parents let him continue to meditate until he was done, and then they all went home. The traits on display in that story, extraordinary devotion and an independent spirit, would characterize Yogananda's life as a celebrated guru. So would another quality, indomitable will. By way of illustration, he once recalled the time he was drawn to orange candies in a drugstore. He wanted some of that candy. His nurse refused and wheeled him home in his carriage. After dinner, he reiterated his desire to his mother. She too said no. He repeated the demand more loudly. She again refused. Mukunda was unrelenting. He grew more adamant with each shout until his mother finally gave in. By then, it was so late she had to wake up the store owner to get her son the treat. The victory was sweeter than the candy itself. He was branded as naughty, but he had learned a vital lesson about the power of will. He would grow up using his will to accomplish extraordinary things, including teaching others how to harness the power of their own will. Other childhood traits would also serve Yogananda well later in life. One was a facility with language. The Gauchos spoke their native Bengali, but also needed enough Hindi and English to get by outside of Bengal. And St. Andrew's, an all-boys school in Gorakhpur, had Mukunda's education began. The British and Christian influence was strong, and English was part of the curriculum. By all indications, he was an articulate child who knew how to use his verbal skills to get what he wanted. He also displayed a knack for prose and poetry, foreshadowing Yogananda's prolific literary output. As is recalled in Mejda, Mejda is a book about Master written by his younger brother, Sananda Lagosh. It's a wonderful book. He also displayed a knack for prose and poetry. His first known poem was composed when he was 8. Heartbroken over the death of his treasured goldfish, he wrote in English, "My red fish is die." D-I-E. Mukunda was also relentlessly persistent, so much so that less tolerant parents might have labeled him obstinate or stubborn and disciplined him accordingly. The Gauchos, however, seemed to have recognized something special in their little Moko, M-O-K-O, must be a family nickname for Mukunda. They responded to his willful and often inconvenient behavior with patience and perhaps a certain amount of pride. I've noticed that in Indian families, that very small children are given a lot of latitude. That may have been because so many of the child's demands were motivated by spiritual objectives that are rare among adult, much less 8 or 9 year olds. But as we saw with the orange candy, even when an ordinary childhood desire is thwarted, his determination to get what he wanted could be intrepid. One telling instance, he resorted to the kind of ascetic rigor we associate with nonviolent resistors like Mahatma Gandhi. It occurred shortly before his 9th birthday, after the family had moved to Lahore, now a major city in Pakistan. When Mukunda was not permitted to attend a traveling exhibition featuring a famous pair of wrestlers, he locked himself in his father's room. He stayed there for 24 hours, refusing food and causing his father to miss time at work because he could not access his clothing. The protest succeeded. Mejda unbolted the door and came out of the room as though he had conquered the world, says Sananda Lagosh. He got to see the wrestlers. While he loved amusements, candy, and play as much as any other kid, Macunda's principal passion was as rare as a cold front in an Indian August. He was a spiritual prodigy, attracted to tales of saints and yogis the way other boys were to athletes and warriors. And he was drawn to solitary silence at an age normally associated with clamor and attention-seeking. His brother Sananda reported in Mejda that Macunda would frequently sit in secluded places and meditate with his eyes closed or half-closed, sometimes murmuring inaudibly in the manner of someone praying or voicing an invocation. In the stories that came down to us are true, Macunda's devotion was rewarded by spectacular spiritual experiences. At one point, jealous that his sister received letters in the mail and he did not, he wrote to God, as reproduced in English in Mejda. Master wrote, "To your beautiful lotus feet, my Bhagavan. How are you? Are you ill? I talk to you every day and ask you to send me a letter. Probably you have forgotten my request. I am very hurt. You know that many letters come to my father and mother and eldest brother, but no one sends a letter to me. Certainly, you will send me a letter. Please write quickly. Don't forget about it. What else should I write? Father and mother are well." Thus bowed Macunda. He mailed it in a sealed envelope addressed to Splendid God-Heaven. Every day he watched eagerly for the postman. He cried and prayed and he scolded the Lord. Then it is said he was awakened one night in the presence of a brilliant celestial light. He was certain that the visitation was the long-awaited reply from God. Another experience would have a lasting impact on Yogananda's life. Alone in his room one morning, he slipped into reverie. A philosophical query arose. What is behind the darkness of closed eyes? Instead of being dispelled by thoughts of football or homework, as it might be with most children, the query triggered an inner vision of bright celestial light, and then, as he later described it, divine shapes of saints sitting in meditation posture in mountain caves formed like miniature cinema pictures on a large screen of radiance within my forehead. He asked them who they were. "We are the Himalayan yogis," they said. He expressed a desire to emulate them. The beings promptly disappeared, but the silvery beams expanding in ever-widening circles to infinity. And a voice said, "I am Ishwara, I am light." The presence faded, but in the aftermath of the ecstatic experience, Yogananda came away impassioned with the determination to find God. The inspiration would last a lifetime, and the beneficiaries of that inspiration number in the millions. Gives you a little idea how he writes about his childhood. Some retelling from the autobiography in Mejda, some original material. The vast majority of the book is about his time here in America. And I always found it fascinating that in the autobiography, Master tells so much about his days of sadhana, seeking out saints, different spiritual experiences, his days and years with Sri Yukteswar, his guru, and then coming to America, and then is largely silent about all of his time here in America. He picks up the narrative once again when Sri Yukteswar calls him back to India some 16 years later. And it's a very interesting thing. And suddenly he's the disciple going back to his guru once again and seeing saints. And what I derived from that was that Master wanted to tell the story of what it was like to be an aspirant and a disciple of a guru. That those things are not as widely known here in the West. And he wanted to portray that in a way that people could identify with it, understand it. and perhaps even emulate that. This great quest that we are on, this greatness of what is below the surface, what is in the deeps of the ocean, it is not something that is oftentimes easily found. There are some cases in which a certain grace descends upon us and we are lifted up into an experience. Sometimes it comes as a response to prayer. Sometimes it's just something that happens in our life. I had early contact with God, but I didn't know that it was Him. I would sit in my room, and what I called the sound of silence, later on Simon Garfunkel came with that song, but at that time I called the silence of sound this tremendously powerful sound that I was hearing. And it would be so loud it would hurt my head. And later on, through my meditation experiences, I came to know that this was the Om sound. But I didn't know it at the time. But it was when I was a later teen that I prayed deeply to God. I was in a spiritual crisis, and I felt such tremendous spiritual pain inside of me, such a degree of separation. But I didn't really know or identify it as something that was spiritual at the time. I only knew that I was in such tremendous pain. I felt that my heart was breaking into, literally, I could feel it split right down the center of my chest, in that heart center, not over in the physical heart. And so I talked to God, whom I had very little faith or understanding in at the time. And I said, God, I don't know if you exist or not, but if you do, if I have never needed you before, I need you now. And instantly, I felt as if 1,000 pounds was taken off of my shoulders, and that tremendous pain in my heart was lifted as well. And I was amazed at it. And at first, I started rationalizing and thinking, well, I was thinking something was going to happen, so something did happen, and I was trying to talk myself into that. I did it just through the power of my own mind and my own thoughts. But that quickly collapsed, because I realized, no matter how hard I would have thought, I couldn't have done that. The pain, what I had experienced at the time, was far too great. That this was indeed a response from God, whatever that was. But I had been touched by that experience. I had been changed by that experience. And even though later on much of the pain came back to me, nevertheless, I knew that something real had happened in that moment. And that really put me onto the search. I'd been interested in metaphysical things before that, but never in so much of the nature of God. More how this world and this universe works, and what's beyond this world. I had grown up in a fairly moderate Methodist home and church. But at some point when I realized that the message was that only Christians would go to heaven and all the rest were sentenced to hell, I could make no sense. I was 12 years old at the time. And so I rejected that God. And many people hang on to their resentments. They hang on to the ignorance of what others have told them, or perhaps hypocrisy that they've seen by others. And they don't give God a fair chance. Sometimes I say I'm out to redeem the good name of God. Not that He needs me to do that, but it's a way of saying it. It's a way of explaining. We don't have to accept the old notions of God. We can wipe the slate clean and have an open inquiry. What is God? What is the nature of God? What is the nature of my relationship with God? These are excellent places to start. But we're not looking at mere intellectual inquiry. That just keeps us up on the surface. where the waves go back and forth and alternate. The mind can say what God is not. It is not filled with hate or prejudice. You would not go out and kill others in the name of God. You might protect somebody, but that's a far different thing. And so you begin to discern what is not God. You begin to whittle away. There's a lovely story of the two stones in the temple. And the two stones were, the first was the step that went up to the altar. The second stone was the image of God at the top of the altar. And one night when all the pilgrims had gone, and it was very, very quiet, the stone step made an inquiry to the stone statue. And he said, "Hey, you up there?" And the stone statue said, "Yes." He says, "You and I are made up of the same substance. And yet when the pilgrims come, they step all over me. They drop things on me. They pay no attention to me. But you, they cover with sandal paste. They put flowers around you. They burn incense to you and they worship you. How do you explain this? You and I are made up of the same material." And the stone statue said, "Well, it is like this." He said, "The stonemason, the carver, started with you. And he saw there a possibility to reveal the image of God inside of you. And so he started to chip away of everything that was not God. And it hurt you, and you didn't like it. And you resisted and you howled so much that he finally set you aside. And then he started on me. And it was painful for me as well. But I thought to myself, there must be some reason, some purpose, why he is doing this. And gradually, as he chipped away everything that was not of God, gradually the image of God was revealed inside the stone. All that outer dross was taken away. And the beauty and the loveliness and the inspiration was all revealed. And that is why they come and they step all over you and pay no attention to you. And why they give me worship and devotion." That's a beautiful story. And it tells of our attitude. When God takes us in hand and he begins to chisel us, and if we think he's made some mistake here and we start to resist him at every turn, then he may set us aside. But if we think with patience, with faith, with understanding, with perfect trust, there is something wonderful occurring here. And as a result of this, I don't know what's going to be the end result. But I trust there is something wonderful going on here, even though it's painful, even though it's difficult. You know, it's been an interesting little time that God has been taking me through. And one of the things that he has taken me through is I tore one of the tendons in the biceps. And every once in a while, I lift it in a certain direction, and it's a stabbing pain. A stabbing pain that shoots right through. And so I've worked with pain down through the years. Papa Ram Dass, I'll go back a little further. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says that pleasure and pain are the same to the yogi. That can be a tough one. Obviously, as human beings, we like pleasure more than we like pain. And yet, the yogi, that one who is in union with God, will get to the point where he will see them as one and the same thing. That's quite a task. Quite a task. But Papa says it just a little bit differently. He says, pain and bliss are the same. That's different, isn't it? Than pleasure and pain are the same. Pain and bliss are the same. So not only are you looking at these two things, pleasure and pain, as the same, but now you're seeing pain as bliss. And Papa describes that as he walked all over India and went through all these different experiences, he could be walking on sharp rocks. His feet would be bleeding. He would feel the pain sensations, but he would feel them as bliss. So I was at an Anandashram in 1999, and I became very ill, high fever, and I stayed in my room, and I didn't tell anybody about it because I didn't want to bother anyone. And so for several days, I had this high fever going on. And I told Papa, I said, you have to show me, how is it the pain and bliss are the same? And it was late at night, and I had this high fever raging through and a lot of physical pain. And suddenly this vision came to me, and I saw Papa. And he had little or no hair on his head. He had no teeth in his mouth. And he was open mouthed with me. He was laughing, and he took my hands, and he held my hands, and he started us dancing around in a circle. And I felt bliss. Even though I still had this fever, even though I still had this pain, I felt bliss. And it helped to teach me how pain and bliss are the same. So I had this pain that is inside my shoulder, and it would shoot straight through. And in part of my work with pain, I've learned to not allow it to come directly into the brain and park itself there. We can get very sensitized to pain. And then pain comes into the brain, and it's like a sponge. It just soaks it up. And we feel it very intensely. And so part of my practice has been seeing that pain impulse to come up from the, in this case, from the shoulder area. And it passes straight through the brain, and it goes into a column of light in front of me. So that the brain is a witness and sees it bypassing straight through. But it goes straight into the cloud of light. And then God did something very interesting. He took that pain impulse and he turned it into light. And with my internal vision, when I would turn my shoulder in a certain way, instead of feeling pain there, it just registered as light. And what I assume was probably greater pain was greater light. Isn't God interesting? And this path that we're on is so fascinating. When we let go of fear, when we let go of, this is not right, my life is not right. Now that doesn't mean that we can't aspire for a better life and better things. Of course, that is God's evolutionary force inside of us. But there is also a certain acceptance in the moment. This moment is perfect. It is perfect. And it is God. And whatever form God is coming to me, then I see it as perfect. Papa is such a wonderful example of that as he traveled around India. And it wasn't that everybody was kind and loving to him. Sometimes people were very rough with him. And he described how one time they were thrown off the train because they traveled as sadhus. They had no money. They didn't pay for tickets. Sometimes they were allowed to stay on the train. Sometimes they were tossed off. In this case, they were tossed off, and then they were made to line up. And the station manager came along, and the first sadhu was there. And he started taking him by the hair. He started shaking his head around. And Papa looked over, and the sadhu was just in bliss as his head was being shaken over and he's being abused by the station manager. And Papa was trying to shove the other fellow out of the way so that the station manager would abuse him for a while because he wanted some of that bliss too. That's the kind of craziness, the madness for God that can take possession of us. And you can get into the spirit of it. You can start putting yourself, God is coming to me as this person. God is coming to me as this situation. He means well. He means that I should learn something. He means that I should see God in this form, in no matter what version. You know, from a human standpoint, if people like us, if they treat us well, then we like them. If they don't treat us well, then we don't like them. Jesus said it this way. He said, love your enemies. Love your enemies. Can you imagine? And he said, what virtue is there in loving the people who love you? Anybody does that. But if you are my disciple, you love your enemies too. And it can be quite a tall order. It demands the strictest of sadhana, that we have our minds focused upon God, that we are surrendered to Him. Now, this does not necessarily mean that you put up with abuse from somebody else. It depends. There may be times when you are Papa standing in line and you're actually trying to line up for it. And then there are other times when you are made to stand up for what is right and what is true. And it's the hardest thing you can do. You'd rather sit back rather than confront some evil that is going. So you see, there's no one rule around all of that. But what you don't do is you don't operate out of hate. You don't allow anger to control you. Now, there is such a thing as righteous anger. And we can speak with righteous anger. Sometimes people need it. They need a little wake-up call because what they're doing is not correct. One time, Papa was talking to some of the workmen at the ashram. And he had his voice raised, and he was speaking in a fairly strict way. I saw Swami Satchitananda do that as well. And Mother was standing behind Papa, and she was watching all of this. And suddenly Papa turned around, and he saw Mother, and he said, Mother, did you think Ram Dass was angry? She said, I don't know, Papa, were you? He said, no, it's just the way you need to talk to these chaps to get them to do anything. And sometimes that's the case. You stand up for yourself. You speak strongly. But anger is not in control. You are in perfect self-mastery. And we know the difference. And one of the things I've noticed is when anger speaks through you, or any one of us, it does not adhere to truth. It exaggerates. It goes over the top. It wants to injure, it wants to hurt. And that's different than wanting to correct a certain situation. And when you speak as God speaking through you with that righteous anger, when you're done with it, you feel clean and clear. You can look back and everything that you have said is the truth, and you have no emotional hangover from it. You feel exactly right about what you've done. You've said exactly enough and not more. And these are clues that you've been right in tune. And you've not gone over the top. So you see, you can live in this world. But you're not driven by the lower forces. This is what self-mastery means. You're taking your instructions from the higher intelligence, from the higher consciousness. You're diving deep into that ocean. immersing yourself, bringing up the great pearl of realization, and then allowing that to inform you as to how to operate in this life. This is the most fascinating, the most demanding, the most loving, the most enlightening life you can possibly imagine living. It's everything, because as Mother would say, God is life and life is God. But in order to really know God, not just give it lip service, we have to be willing to do the work, to dive deep, to find that pearl. Not be satisfied with just a little dunk under the water. But to go down deep, and to do that, we have to expend the time and the effort and go until we get the results. Master would say, I begin meditating when most people are ending it. And I don't stop until I've had God contact. Now, I realize that people have schedules to keep, work to go to, appointments to keep, and so on. So it's not always possible. But through the week, to find some times when you can take that extra time so that you can go deeper. And you know, many a times I was dropping down into deeper and deeper levels, and then suddenly some thought would come along and I'd pop right up back to the surface. And through analysis, I realized there was some fear that I encountered. In the ocean, there are these different thermal layers. And they're just like going up in trees higher and higher. And there's, if you go up into higher and higher trees, there's certain animals and birds that live at certain levels, but they don't live above. It's this whole echo culture at that particular level. And same thing with the thermal levels. There's certain fish, there's certain mammals that live at certain levels, but they don't live at other levels. And they become like floors and ceilings. And your interior consciousness has something similar. You drop down, and then suddenly you face resistance. Your mind starts presenting you with the desire nature, or with repulsion, or with fear. And when that happens, you know that you're standing on the precipice of going into a brand new state of consciousness. When you're getting the most resistance, you stand to gain the greatest victory, when you persevere, when you stick with it. I've had fear come up in me, and I'd say generally, I'm not a fearful person. Growing up, I wasn't generally a fearful person. I had such tremendous fear come up in me. I wanted to be anywhere except be seated on my meditation blanket. But I hung in there. I kept going. I didn't quit. And I'm so thankful that I was given the grace, the inspiration, the support from my guru to keep going, to not give up, to not get dissuaded. I do understand why people quit meditating. And when you analyze it, some desire nature or some fear, two sides to the same ego coin, had come up and drawn that one off. So I understand it. But I also see what lies in store. When you fight against those things, when you work with it, and it's not that every day you're perfectly successful at it, but you hang in there, you keep yourself on the field. And gradually, gradually, you and grace, God's grace, allows you to go beyond that barrier. And you know, when you do, you look back and you think, what was the big deal? It doesn't seem like a big deal now, but boy, it sure did at the time. And then you're free of it. You're free to explore the new level. And it doesn't bother you anymore until you get to the next level. And then you get to more oppositional force. So expect it. Know what it is. Understand it. You are facing yourself. One time God gave me the image of living in a village. And one day decided to go out for a walk. And from that village, it was mostly downhill. And oh, it's just such a beautiful day, and really enjoyed being out walking. And I got out so far, and then I was very, very tired, and I wanted to go back to the village. Now I had to retrace all of my steps. Only this time, instead of going downhill, now I was going uphill. And I began to think, what in the world did I do to myself here? I went out so far, and now it seems so difficult getting back to the village. And this is what our spiritual sadhana is like. That when we turn around, we face all those things that we did in our outward journey from God. And we're doing nothing but facing ourselves. And we think, why are we being so put upon? Why are we being punished? And we're not being punished at all. We're just simply retracing our steps and going back to the source. It's as if you had taken out a credit card. And you thought, well, this is fun. I can just go out and get what I want. How fun is that? And so you buy this thing and you buy that thing, and pretty soon you run up a big bill. And then the bill comes in the mail and you think, oh my goodness, how am I going to pay this off? And then you wonder whether it was worth it or not. What did I really get from all of this? And then I have to not only pay that off, but I have less money to have fun with in other ways. So I feel poorer than ever in order to pay off that credit. And yet I owe the bank. And in a spiritual sense, there's no claiming bankruptcy. You have to pay it. You have to pay it. That's the truth. So instead of running up more debt, let us turn and face towards the light. Let us pay whatever it is that we owe. Let us get ourselves and let us earn our freedom. There is so much joy. There's so much bliss. There's so much power of God. There is so much wisdom and truth to be explored. And yet we just live on the surface, getting tossed around by the waves. Dive deep. Let us be like Papa, a diver of the deep. Find that pearl of great price, the pearl of realization. And live beyond fear, beyond darkness, live in the light and the bliss and the joy of that presence. So let me stop there and see if there's any questions about your spiritual practice and your sadhana, anything that I've talked about and touched on tonight, or anything that's you're battling, keeping you from diving into the greater depths. Unless, of course, you're all perfectly diving all the way to the bottom and getting the pearl.
How do you take three Kriya breaths and then go straight into samadhi?
Well, it can happen to you when the pathway has been perfected. And when you feel that wide openness in the spine, and it's not something that you have to plan. When I first read about breathlessness of yogis, it was before I met Mother. And I thought, well, if being breathless is the key to the thing. Then I took out a watch and I started timing myself to see how long I could hold my breath. not recommended, and not useful. When you are in that bliss of God, when you feel that stillness, and then suddenly a breath comes in and you realize, I haven't been breathing all of this time. I've just been aware of this stillness and of this bliss. Then you have gotten to where Kriya is to take you. What Kriya does is it perfectly balances your spine and your brain. It has all the opposites, heat and warm, or heat and cool, inside, outside, up, down, and it perfectly balances your spinal and brain system and brings it into that state of perfect equanimity. That's the purpose of it. You so oxygenate your blood that allows you just to be in perfect stillness. Now you could have either a very slight, light breathing or no breath at all. So it's something that comes on its own through our spiritual practice, through the purification of our brain and our mind, through the purification of our nervous system. And when it happened so seamlessly, so easily, that sometimes we don't recognize it until we start breathing again. So it's not something that you can just say, okay, I'm going to set that as a goal to have 3 Kriya breaths and that's it. But there may come a time when you have a Kriya breath or two. This is the way that it usually happens for me. I start having a Kriya breath or two and there are no more breaths. It's just that perfect equanimity. To continue having Kriya breath, then Kriya breath begins to spontaneously go in the spine. And you feel the vibrancy traveling in the spine, much as we visualize the Kriya breath being when we're breathing. Only there's no breath that's going by itself. And we have that perfect stillness and equanimity. Then it would be bringing the mind down to try to take Kriya breaths after that. So if that's happening to us, then we simply go into that stillness and we maintain it. If then the mind starts getting activated again and the breath starts coming, then just continue your Kriya breath with that. Because that's all the purification of the spine and the brain and of the mind. Both the conscious mind and the subconscious mind.
I was thinking about what Master said in one of his audio talks. It's like, I take 3 breaths and dump my mind into the unconscious, into the superconscious.
That's when you have the pathway all ready. That can be all that, even 1 breath or 2 breaths, and you're done. Then you get to the point where that is alive inside of you, whether you're breathing or not. Whether you're taking a Kriya breath or whether you're just walking around in an ordinary kind of way, you have that full spinal and brain consciousness, and you're merged in God, and God is merged in you. And yet, you walk, you talk, you act in this world. It looks much like anybody else does. And yet, your interior life is completely transformed. These are all the possibilities of what can happen for us as we make progress along the path. So, when you're doing your Kriya breath, and you're at the end, Babaji once said, doing Kriya without immersing yourself in the after effect of Kriya is like making a meal and then not bothering to eat it. So you do your kriya, you get involved in the spine and the brain, you feel that activating force inside of you, you bring it into balance, and then when you're done with your kriya breaths, then just really pay attention, really work to stay in that zone, in the kriya zone, where you just have that stillness. And even if you have thoughts, they're like clouds floating above. They don't capture you. They don't pull your attention. You might be aware, oh, there's thoughts going there, but they seem inconsequential. What seems real is the vital reality of spiritual consciousness, of being awake in that divine consciousness. So practice that, and with that, that helps to purify the mind. See all of your thoughts as just clouds high above. They're there. They're floating through, but they have no real pull for you. And then you can be like that for a little while, and then you have a thought that comes through. Oh, maybe it's time to go to work now. Or I have to do this, or I have to do, or I want to do this, or want to do that. And suddenly, you're pulled into identification with this body and with this world. And it can be maddening because it's not really what you want. But that thought has the power to attach itself to you, and you attach yourself to it. That's what attachment is. And you attach yourself to it, and it pulls you down from that high state. More sadhana, more purification. That's what that means.
What if you just burst out laughing right at the end of kriya? I've had that happen like 5 or 6 times now. Or I'm just completely still, and then out of nowhere, I just start burst up.
Sometimes the energy wants to express itself. You know, people come to service and you're indrawn and you're meditative, and then people start to talk and it becomes a Tower of Babel. And it's people are not used to holding that energy inside, so it wants to express itself in some way. And we lose something when we do that. So, joy is certainly a part of it, but laughter like that tends to be an expulsion of energy. So, be aware that that can happen, and then just work with that. Why do I need to expel that energy? Can I open up a wide highway inside my spine and see that energy lifting up in my spine? And holding that, and then expanding my consciousness so that I'm not just this human body. My consciousness can spread out over all space. And I would wager that if your consciousness were expanded out over all space, you would not want to burst out laughing like that. Just, it wouldn't be there. Smile might be there. Joy might be there. But not that expulsion. So let's be sure to be growing our consciousness so it gets big. When you feel pressure, and these things oftentimes happen, you feel pressure in your ajna or in your medulla as this high energy comes in, your heart center. You feel pressure and it can get quite painful. Work on in your mind, thinking of expanding out into all space, and then see whether that pressure doesn't reduce or not. Ego wants to contract. That's because it wants control over things. Spirit wants to expand. That becomes a battleground. Ego wants to contract it too much. It becomes painful. It becomes a lot of different things. Becomes resistance, and just to breathe, open, and allow. breathe, open, and allow. Feel the freedom of spirit in that omniscience, that expansiveness. Isn't this the best? There is no more demanding journey, nor is there a more fulfilling journey than being on this spiritual path. Okay, everybody filled up? Pranams, I bow to the great light within you. May God and Gurus ever bless you, guide you, fill your waiting spirit with the infinite peace, joy, light, intelligence, of divine mind. It's been a lovely evening, and thank you, Joshua, for kicking things off and getting us all together. And thank you, Rick and Terry, I know isn't able to be there tonight, for opening your homes, your home and your hearts. So lovely to see you all.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Om Tat Sat. Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Hari Om.
Hari Om.